the top.
So what did you think Kimberly's email about the finance?
The whose email?
The one from Kimberly about, oh, we're gonna do our own thing, you guys have gotten to your own thing.
Oh, Michelle.
Michelle.
I thought it was fine. I mean, basically what they're saying is that we can go ahead and do our annotation and then we'll merge and then they get the last say, which is sort of what we're talking about the joke thing anyway.
Right.
But I don't know what to do. So how big is the problem of these redundant sequences?
Good.
You tell me, I mean.
I emailed Bill and Michelle this morning saying what is there's duplications, sometimes multiple.
Did you look at this?
I've been overwhelmed. I got as far as emailing. My job is to email coordinate. Your job is to work. I don't know what to do.
Well, why don't we sort of, Nikki wants to blast everything against everything. Some of this is being done in Magpie for the first 50 or so by tomorrow morning. So what I'm doing is I'm blasting all the Magpie rules against the callback percent. Actually, it's found cascading. So that if Magpie called exactly the same mark as Tiger did, then it'll show up in that evidence section as a 100% homology right there.
And is it from X to X? So what's really worrying me is that Tiger supposedly sent us this linear sequence of the genome. How can the entire genome be different?
Yeah, it's
they screwed up.
They did screw up.
Okay, this means that the C-Corp people were messed up to even get it.
Yeah, you know,
I mean,
we
so
should
they,
look at
no, they're going to go up and stand up in front of this national meeting and say, we're going to have it all in order, and we have. And then I don't want to get up there and say, oops, you're wrong.
I mean, you probably shouldn't be saying it's wrong.
But
we should know what's going on. We can find regions. I know exactly. So what happens is when you're looking at, say you have,
Is it a complete context?
It doesn't look like complete context, but it looks like big regions of specific context.
Are there junctions between? It's clear if they don't know.
I haven't looked at it that closely. Nikhil might be able to answer that. That's what we're going to meet up in class and discuss it. But what I've seen is that, so in these results, you'll see the results of the FASTA homology, and you'll get two ORFs that are precisely the same score, which is impossible.
Right.
And there are two different Tiger ORFs that are identically the same, you know, identical. I haven't seen it worse than two, but I only have data on the first 20 groups by this morning. So, I have the first 50 groups blasted, blast N, blast P, and the first 50 groups done with the FASTA search against the Kalibacker is. That's a FASTA 3P, so it's a protein amino acid one. I won't have the HTML and the reports generated
before
tomorrow. By tomorrow, I will have the HTML and the reports generated for the FASTA for all the first 50. But I will not. We won't have the full data set before you go. This is too time for any friends. When are you leaving exactly?
I've got a flight Saturday, but I don't know what time.
Okay, so yeah, no, the weekend will be when the majority of the rest of the blasting is done.
Okay, we can
But, you know, we can get for 70.
But I'm wondering if this is why when Newman's sitting back and he said, you know, we've got all these transporters. Is it that they're duplicates? You know, he says the contractor specifies
drug transporters
and things like that.
It looks like the regions that are repeats are somewhat close together. Like, you'll see ORF 6455 be exactly identical to ORF Tiger ORF 62. You know, they're not more than 1,000 ORF columns, which tells you something about how close they are in the actual linear sequence.
I'm
getting
a really bad example. Okay, let's see. Today we're going to talk about transcription. You've only got a couple more lectures. You've got this lecture and the next lecture prior to an exam. I have not scheduled a room for us to do a review session in. I need to talk about times, but I think I'll introduce these guys first. Anyway, there is an ongoing mission to make sure that your education is of high quality and good standards. And one of the challenges is to make sure that not only at the professor level do we stand up and we at least try to speak coherently to you, but we also try to make sure that our graduate teaching assistants have a lot of training and they have different exposures, different styles of teaching and that sort of thing. And all of your TAs actually go through TA training workshops, and the degree of the training workshop will depend upon the student that comes in. Anyway, somebody's brilliant idea as part of the training is to have them look at transcripts from different sorts of lecturers. And Don't ask me. So we're going to get recorded today. And some poor, unfortunate soul will have to read the transcripts at some point, or they'll pick it apart at some point, or I don't know what's going to happen. But why don't I introduce these guys, and they'll tell you what's really going on. I just sort of say yes to things that are easy.
And we appreciate it very much. My name is Rita Simpson. Janine Ovens is my assistant. We're here today on behalf of the U of M's English Language Institute. And we're recording this class today as part of a research project started in winter of 98 to collect about 175 hours of spoken English from a wide range of academic settings. The purpose of collecting this data, formally called a corpus, is to provide a source of authentic speech for use in English language teaching and testing materials, including things like the TA training workshops that she just mentioned, and other kinds of linguistic research. Professor Maddock has given us permission to do this recording with the understanding that no identifying information, like last names, for instance, will be used in the transcript. Your participation in today's class implies your consent to the recording and to the use of this data for teaching and research purposes, unless you let us know afterwards that there are parts of your speech you'd rather not have included in the transcript. One of the ways the transcript will be used is as part of an online web-accessible database available to linguists for research purposes. The website is hosted by the University's Humanities Text Initiative. Are there any questions about the recording today or this project? Thank you very much for letting us do this.
I can tell you're all going to be quiet all day long. You're going to say, I'm not going to say a word. But it could be worse. I was actually webcast once, where it was like nationwide webcast. That was very weird. So my lab could log on and watch me while I was in rap and speaking. That's very bizarre. Anyway, okay, so just ignore Google Man behind the curtain. All right, so we want to talk about transcription. Next Thursday, we're going to move on and do some introductory molecular biology. And the goals are to get you to the point where you can start reading papers. Okay, so we've only got two more lectures in order to get you to the point where I think that you're going to be comfortable reading papers. I do need to schedule a review time. It's going to be next Wednesday, the 16th. I assume there's going to be all kinds of labs and conflicts, but let's start marching through the day to see if we can find a time that you're shaking your head. No way.
Bad day.
Bad day. How bad
unless,
is
unless
it?
It's really, really early.
Okay.
Okay, or after 11:30 at night.
That's well, I'll be up.
Is Wednesday the only day we do it? Is Wednesday the only day we do it?
Well, the problem is I'm out of town. I don't get back in town until Tuesday late. I don't know what time my flight gets back. I could conceivably do it Tuesday evening. Is that better?
Yeah. I have class till 10, though. 7 till 10.
I don't want to do it at 10. weren't you the problem last time?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay, we're missing one on each. Is there anybody else that has a problem on Wednesday night? We have multiples. Anybody else has a problem on Tuesday night? It doesn't matter, 7, 8, 9, something. After 9, I'm asleep, so, I mean.
Could we do it a little earlier, like?
Well, I don't know what time my flight gets in. I have to fly in from D.C., and depending upon the weather, I think I leave at 1 or 2. I should be back by 5 or 6, but we need flex time in case of traffic and stuff. The last thing I want is you guys sit in the room and me not there. So let's assume 7 or on Tuesday, or all day Wednesday, any time, but that looks like it's not going to work. Okay, so some of you are just not going to be able to show up, so we need to find out what is the least inconvenient time. How many don't want to do it Tuesday? Okay, how many don't want to do it Wednesday? No, you don't want to get one vote. Okay, so it's going to have to be Tuesday. The three or four of you that cannot attend on Tuesday, email me. Okay, make sure that you do all the study guide questions. You make sure that if you have any concerns, any questions, email me. And what would be better is if you can buddy up with somebody that's actually went to the review session. Okay, so it will be Tuesday evening, and I will tell you the time. Is 7 o'clock okay? Is 8 o'clock better? Okay. 7 just feels right. So I will make it 7 unless if my flight plans say that I can't. And we can go until 9, and so if you can't make it at 7, but you show up at 8, that's okay. We'll just make it a couple hours long. Okay, I will give your study guides on Thursday. Same format, do all the questions, make sure you've read the book, make sure you do the questions in the back of the book. It should be relatively straightforward. Okay, last lecture I completely messed up trying to explain migration of holiday structures and gene conversions. I've decided that instead of trying to do it a second time, I will just refer you to the figures. Your figures in your textbook are actually clear. If you want to know about gene conversion, go to page 230, figure 9.5. And if you didn't understand the migration of the holiday junctions, I think page 220, the figure 9.2 is relatively clear. If you still don't understand it, email me or we'll go over it during the review session, okay? In your course pack, I had told you that we were actually going to be in Chapter 11 today. That's true. I'm going to pick up a little bit in Chapter 12, which is on page 297 to 305, and I'll explain why when we get there. And I want you to go back to Chapter 2 and read page 47 to 51, because some of the introductory things that I want to talk about, we sort of skipped. We skipped earlier on in the quarter, or in the semester. What I want to do today is start with the really fundamental basics of transcription and gene control and sort of work my way to some more detailed mechanisms. And the reason is that many of you have had molecular biology and you're sick to death of this and you know it really well, and some of you are juniors and this is your first upper level and you don't really remember it or you never really learned it right the first time when you were exposed to it. So let's just start from the beginning. I'll try to move relatively quickly. And I'll try to use examples that maybe you haven't had before or you haven't had extensively before. So transcription basically means that you're going from a DNA molecule and you're making an RNA molecule. And the RNA can be messenger RNA, transfer RNA, ribosomal RNA. It doesn't have to be messenger RNA, although we're really biased and we almost always say that you're going to make an mRNA. And in order for a gene to be transcribed, part of the sequence has to be read. If this is just a double-stranded DNA molecule, okay, going 5' direction to 3', left to right, the RNA is going to be read by the template strand, okay, which is the bottom. So the RNA is going to look, in essence, identical to the top strand, and I almost always write it like this. So this is an mRNA or an RNA going 5' to 3'. And if you remember, the difference in the RNA molecule is that you're not going to have T's, you're going to have U's. So every place that you had a T up here, you had a U. And this is convenient, and it's convention. So every time you're reading a paper or you're looking at a DNA sequence, and they only give you one strand, they usually give you the top strand. And it's exactly what the RNA is going to look like. So you can just transcribe it in your head back and forth. They should almost always go 5' to 3'. So this molecule looks exactly like that. It was coded for that. Now, in order for transcription to occur, you need to have RNA polymerase find the right place on the DNA and to initiate transcription. You're all aware that RNA polymerase or RNAP transcribes. And it has to first find the place to start transcription. You don't transcribe all of the genomic DNA. You only transcribe where there's a gene. You only transcribe where there's a gene that you want to transcribe. And if we now condense this down to the level of a gene, I often draw the open reading frames as boxes. You've seen this before. So this is some sort of open reading frame. Upstream of the open reading frame is going to be what's termed a promoter. And the promoter is the location that RNA polymerase will actually bind. It contains not only the sequences that RNA polymerase binds to, but it also contains all of the DNA sequences that other protein factors might bind to that control it. So the promoter contains cis-actin sequences, same DNA sequences that proteins bind to. Okay, and proteins can include RNA polymerase itself, it can include activators and repressors, okay, which we'll get into more, things that turn up expression, things that turn down expression. What I want to do is just sort of get into the basic features of a promoter first. All promoter regions are going to have four things in common in bacteria. Okay, they have four features. And the four features are either spacing or particular sites. So for instance, the first feature is the start site. You've often seen this, it's called a plus one. Okay, on diagrams, people mark the place the transcription starts is the plus one. Okay, so on this little diagram, the plus one would be the first nucleotide that comes off here. Or if we wanted to put that on the DNA sequence, you would say that was the plus one. It's the very first nucleoside. Yeah.
I missed it because I was writing, but four features of the open reading frame or the promoter?
Four features of a promoter. Yeah, today we're not going to actually deal with the open reading frames at all. I'll give them gene names occasionally, but we don't care. What we're going to do today is talk about different ways in which you can turn genes up, turn genes down, and control gene expression. Okay, so Every transcript is going to have a particular start site. Sometimes it's a little bit sloppy. So if you actually map a start site, you'll see that 80% of the transcript will start at one nucleotide, and then there's 20% will be one nucleotide up, you know, plus or minus from it. But it pretty much starts in one place. The start sites are often, they're often a purine, okay, but not always. So you often see a purine, and adenine or guanine is the site, but it isn't always a purine. The next element that they all have is something called the minus 10 region. And I'm going to give you a specific sequence because then it lets me introduce consensus sequences. Okay, the minus 10 region is a specific DNA sequence. Okay, so it's a cis-acting DNA sequence that has a particular context. The one I want to write down would look like T, A, T, A, A, T. That's a specific minus 10 region for some certain kinds of polymerases, which I'll get to soon. And so when you look at a promoter that's transcribed by these particular RNA polymerases, and you look 6 to 10 base pairs upstream of your plus 1, you're going to see this sequence. Okay? And so where would that be on this little map? So on this open reading frame in the promoter region, we might see that transcript starts there. So this would be the plus one. Okay, we're just making things smaller. The minus 10 then is going to be a specific sequence upstream. We should actually get definitions. If you are in that direction from the plus one, you are upstream. And if you are going that direction, you are downstream. Just to make life difficult, you count backwards. Okay? If this is the plus one, plus two would be the adjacent nucleotide, plus 100 would be 100 nucleotides downstream. You go negative numbers upstream. So this is minus 10, which means the beginning of it is 10 nucleotides upstream. Okay, so that's the second element. The third element is at minus 35. Okay, so it's 35 nucleotides upstream. And a specific sequence that I can give for that would be TTGACA for a particular kind of promoter. For the most frequent promoters that you see in E. coli, that's what you use. The other features that all promoters have is the distance between the minus 10 and the minus 35 is always conserved. Okay, thus their names. You can name the minus 10, minus 35 because that's where you almost always find them. So the fourth feature is the distance is conserved. And it's usually 16 to 18 nucleotides in between the minus 10 and the minus 30. Yeah.
I have a question I'm thinking about counting. Is there a zero?
There's no zero.
You just go plus one, minus one.
Yeah.
And they go from there. Okay.
Isn't that weird?
But that was it. That was weird.
It's math that doesn't work right. Yeah.
So the minus 10 region, is that what we call Tata box?
So this is the Tata box.
Okay. Is the second one have, one have a name?
You know what? I just lied through my teeth. This is not the Tata box. This is, it's because the sequence is Tata.
Right.
Tata box is a particular sequence element that you're going to find in eukaryotic transcription. And I do not know whether this can also be called a Tata. In eukaryotic transcription, when RNA polymerase binds, it specifically recognizes just a Tata. Mm-hmm. There is no minus 35. And I don't know what the relationship is between minus 10 sequence that's Tata and the eukaryotic Tata box.
So if it's really homologous, you can
I don't know if it's the same. It certainly is not the same protein-DNA interaction. So the protein that interacts and identifies these sequences in bacterial DNA for RNA polymerase are not the same as eukaryotic RNA polymerase. Okay. So whether you can call that a Tata box, I don't think so.
Okay.
But I don't know. We'll call them minus 10, minus 35, because I know that's safe.
Okay.
Okay. That gets us down to... No, I don't want to skip yet. Okay. I put these sequences specifically up here because I wanted to emphasize the fact that although this is an idealized sequence, this is not the sequence or the sequences that you're going to find in every promoter. These are consensus sequences. Most promoters are not going to have these specific sequences. And the way that you get, you know, I can write out this and your textbook will say that the minus 10 region is TATAAT. But in reality, for any given promoter, it's going to vary some. They came up with this because what they did is they aligned all the minus 10s from hundreds of promoters and they said, okay, what is the average promoter? So the consensus sequence is an average sequence. From a whole lot of motifs that you lined up. So the consensus for the minus 10 is this, minus 35 is that. A consensus sequence for an activator binding site might, you know, would be something completely different. If you look at the frequency of how often these actually occur, the T is pretty conserved, and 80% of the time there's a T in that position. The A is very well conserved, 95% of the time there's an A. This T you don't see very often, only half the time. It's 45. This A is 60. This one's at 50. And this T is very well conserved. So for any given promoter, it might have a T and then an A and then maybe a G, 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 T. And that's still a good Tata box. It's not a great Tata box, but it would still be recognized. Okay. Similarly, these are equally divergent. Okay. So I just wanted you to have an example. You're not going to always find this sequence and this sequence. And that's why sometimes it's really hard when you're sequence gazing and you're just looking at your gene and you look upstream of your open reading frame, you're trying to find your transcriptional control regions. It's very difficult because they don't look exactly like this. Okay? Now, okay, genes are transcribed at different levels. Okay, not all genes are transcribed at the same level, and this is a good thing because you don't need every protein or every gene product in your cell, or the bacteria don't need every gene product at the same level. Okay, there are times when you need more of some product, there's times when you need less of some product. For instance, ribosomal proteins. Ribosomal proteins, when the cells are rapidly growing in glucose, you need up to 70,000 ribosomes in your cell, or in the bacterial cell, in order to translate everything efficiently. When times are hard and the cell's growing very slowly, you only need about 20,000. And so you don't want to spend all that energy making all those ribosomal proteins when you're not going to use them. Okay, so the cell has a way of coordinately turning things up and turning things down. There are other proteins that you just need at a low level all the time, and so you don't control them as well. One of the mechanisms of control is by how close to consensus these particular motifs are. That a protein that needs to be transcribed very rapidly might be closer to this consensus sequence than one that's transcribed at a very low level. Okay, and this makes sense. If you need these sequences in order for RNA polymerase to find the promoter, it's going to find it a lot more efficiently if you're closer to consensus. Okay, so high transcribed or highly transcribed genes are usually closer to consensus, and not always. Unlike in eukaryotes, in bacteria, most of the control of gene expression occurs at the level of transcription. If you can control how much RNA you make, you can control how much protein you can make. That's not absolutely true, but it's more true for prokaryotes than for eukaryotes. For eukaryotes, there's a lot more levels of control that you can feed into it. Okay, but for prokaryotes, there really aren't. Okay, so we have minus 10 and minus 35 regions. Let's first talk about just what happens at this for the minus 10, minus 35. RNA polymerase will recognize those specific sequences. The molecule, the RNA polymerase itself is composed of five proteins. It's a big complex. It's 465 kilodaltons, so it's very big. And it's composed of a protein that's called beta, a protein that's called beta prime, two proteins that are called alpha, and one protein that's called sigma. In terms of, if we want to compare this to eukaryotic proteins, in eukaryotic RNA polymerase, these three proteins are, you can find similar proteins in eukaryotes. Certainly with beta prime, there are proteins in eukaryotic RNA polymerase that look just like them. The alpha is more divergent. So the molecule is made of one of these, two of these, and something called sigma. These four proteins, the betas and the alphas, are the core polymerase. Okay, so the molecule exists as a, or the RNA polymerase exists as a complex in the cell of those four proteins. The sigma factor comes on and off. Okay, so core plus sigma is the holoenzyme. And it's the holoenzyme that recognizes the DNA. Okay, the holoenzyme recognizes the DNA because the sigma factor recognizes the minus 10 and minus 35 regions. So for the particular sequences that I gave you, the only RNA polymerase that's going to recognize this specific minus 10 and this specific minus 35 is the RNA polymerase that has the sigma 70, okay, sigma factor. If it has a different sigma factor, this protein does not recognize either one of these consensus sequences. Okay, it's a specific protein DNA binding. Okay, so the sigma factors are sort of the designer factors. They can modulate the activity of RNA polymerase. Whichever sigma factor is bound to it will control which gene that polymerase can transcribe. Okay, sigma factors, there's a lot of different flavors. The sigma 70 is the housekeeping. There are other sigma factors which are turned on in response to specific environmental stresses or developmental pathways, or may control different kinds of functions, such as generation of flagella and chemotaxis machinery. I think we will probably be able to read a paper later that talks about turning on and control of different sigma factors and sporulation, and so I don't want to belabor on it. I just want to introduce the concept now, that it's the sigma factor that actually binds to the DNA, and you have different options for what sigma factor and RNA polymerase might be bound to. Okay? I don't want to go into details today, though. Okay. Where am I going? Okay, so finding promoters is going to be due to the function of the sigma factor when it's bound to these molecules. And there was somewhere else I was going. Notes would be a good idea. So this is a good thing to teach the TAs. I don't know where I'm going. Let me go look. All right, let me tell you a couple other things I want you to know. You can control the level of expression not just from RNA polymerase, but you can modulate it due to the interaction of other factors that interact with RNA polymerase. And I want to sort of take you from the big picture and then give you some examples. Okay. There's two basic things you can do. You can either repress transcription or you can activate it. I'm going to draw you a grossly oversimplified version of how each of those processes work. And then I'll give you some more examples that show you how complicated it can be. Okay. If you have a gene somewhere on the chromosome, okay, that it should have a certain minus 10, minus 35 sequence, and RNA polymerase may or may not be able to bind to it. Depending upon how good those minus 10, minus 35s are, you might need other proteins to bind to it. Negative regulation would be a case in which when you add a repressor, the repressor then can bind somewhere in the promoter region and prevent transcription. So when the repressor is bound, you get no transcription. Okay, I actually drew this because I was going to transcribe the repressor. Sorry. Okay. If, however, you can pull the repressor off of the promoter region, or if you can remove it somehow, then you can get transcription. And the way that you usually do that is you add an inducer. An inducer is a molecule that can bind to the repressor, and when it binds to the repressor, it changes the conformation state of the repressor such that it no longer binds to the DNA itself. So when the repressor inducer complex binds, then you get transcription. Okay, you have several examples you should well know by now. For instance, if this was the lac operon, the repressor would be lac I, the inducer would be lactose, allolactose, okay, or IPTG if you're in the lab, okay, and the lac I falls off or cannot bind to its sequences when it's bound to inducer. Okay, what is this black box here that it binds to? We call the region that this binds the operator. Okay, so the operator is where the repressor binds. Okay, and an operator is often just defined as an O. Promoters are often P, even though operators are actually part of promoters, but you'll often see that the promoter they're talking about is often just this binding site, and then you might have an operator next to it. The whole thing is technically the promoter, okay, but you'll see people that'll make a P and then an O. Or figures in your books. Okay, so the default state with repression, okay, is that you're going to express the gene. If the repressor doesn't bind, the gene's going to be expressed. Okay, and if you make a mutation in the repressor, the gene's going to be expressed. If anything happens to mess up the system, your gene is going to be expressed. Okay, you need a specific interaction of this molecule with that DNA sequence, or your gene will be expressed. Okay, with activators, again, you have a gene, and you have some cis-acting sequence to which your activator binds. It'll make an activator look like a lambda phage. So if the activator is bound, we now get transcription. The activator... The activator often needs something else, and we'll give you an example of that. Yeah. So the activator itself sometimes doesn't work unless it binds to something. An example that we'll talk about is the cyclic AMP, the cap cyclic AMP complex. the CAP protein doesn't bind in the absence of cyclic AMP to its cis-acting sequences. Okay, that's not always the case. Sometimes the activator itself can bind down. But the activator needs to find the cis-acting sequences, and it does so by a specific DNA protein contact. The default state, though, is no transcription. Okay, because if the promoter absolutely requires that the activator be there, you're not going to have any transcription if you don't have the activator protein there. And so when you're screening for mutations or when you're looking at, a lot of what Chapter 11 does is it talks a lot about the genetics of how do you identify activators, how do you identify repressors, what kinds of mutations are you looking at. If you get it through your head that the default state is going to be you're transcribing or you're not transcribing, I think the chapter will make a lot more sense. Okay, it goes through a lot of genetic terms, and I think it's well worthwhile doing. I should point out that the chapter focuses very, very heavily on control of the lac operon. I'm specifically not going to use that as an example because you've had it at least three times in your undergraduate career. I don't know if you know it, so read the sections. The pages that you should specifically, that I'm specifically not talking about, that you should specifically read are 265 to 275. 268 to 275. It goes in gory detail about lots of mutations you can make in lac repressors and in operator sequences and in activators, and you should know that by now, but certainly read it and make sure you really know it. Okay. I want to give you a couple of examples of, or an example of an activator, an example of a repressor, just to make sure that it's clear, and then we'll talk about some of the other things that can happen. One of the reasons why E. coli does all of this, that you need repressors or activators, is that you've got a lot of genes to control, and it's really crucial that you keep the levels appropriate. You don't need all this control. If you go to an organism like T7 phage, T7 phage, its RNA polymerase is one protein. Okay, you don't need four proteins. It does it in one protein. But if you're a T7 phage, you have very few genes you need to turn on. You don't need to control the level of expression of all of those genes. If you're a phage and you've invaded into your host and you want to make more phage, you basically turn on everything. You might use that temporal expression that we talked about a couple lectures ago. But it doesn't really matter whether you control the level of transcription. It's more important in controlling do you turn them on or not turn them on. Okay, but T7 polymerase doesn't need, the RNA polymerase doesn't need to have a way to modulate gene expression. E. coli does. Okay, E. coli, it's really critical. And when you get into eukaryotes, this gets really complicated. So an RNA polymerase of yeast is going to have something like 8 or 10 proteins. When you get to higher eukaryotes, it even has more. And the reason you have all these extra proteins is that it's a way of tweaking and modulating transcriptional control. Okay, so this is sort of a, E. coli is a streamlined version. It's a little bit more complicated than phage, and it's a lot less complicated than eukaryotes. Okay, so I want to give just an example of activation because, again, it comes up in lac control, and I think it confuses people sometimes. And that's how catabolite repression works. It's actually not repression, it's an activation, but it's called repression, and it's not my fault. Okay, as you are well aware, bacteria needs certain amounts, I mean, every living organism needs a certain amount of large macromolecules that they can break down into smaller macromolecules in order to live. We often say that you need a carbon source. When you grow up a bacteria, you have to put it on some sort of carbon source. And bacteria can utilize a lot of different kinds of carbon sources, but it has preferred carbon sources. It's easier to break apart glucose than it is to break apart galactose. It's easier to break apart galactose than to break apart arabinose. Okay? So the cell will preferentially try to use different available high energy sources to break down into macromolecules in a temporal order. And in order to do that, it needs to shut off all the genes that are involved in the degradation of the macromolecules it's not degrading. Okay, what you want to do is you want a system that makes all the proteins to degrade glucose until you don't have glucose in the cell. And then you need a way to turn on all the genes that will express the proteins that can then degrade galactose, if galactose is there. If galactose isn't there, then don't turn those on. Okay? And that's where catabolite repression comes in. So catabolites, where the name comes from, these are just breakdown products. Now it's getting hot. Okay, these are breakdown products from larger molecules. And the main product that we need to deal with is actually one of the breakdown products is ATP, which will then get converted to cyclic AMP by adenylate cyclase. Don't worry about the details, it doesn't matter. Okay? But when glucose is high or energy levels are high, your ATP levels are going to be high. Okay? If you've got glucose around by default, you guys remember glycolysis and the Krebs cycle and all of that, all those ATPs you had to memorize? Okay? You have a lot of ATP molecules when you're living on glucose. If you start depleting the glucose, you're going to be running out of ATP, and available ATP will get converted into cyclic AMP. And this is going to be when your energy state basically is lower. And it's signaling to the cell that, hey, we need to switch carbon sources. Cyclic AMP can bind to a protein. So cyclic AMP can bind to an activator that's called CAP. Unfortunately, this has two different names. It's either called CAP or it's called CRP. I don't like either one of the names. This is cyclic, let me make sure. Okay, so this stands for catabolite activating protein. So at least now we're getting away from this repression name. Okay, so this is catabolite activating protein. And I think most people in the field are using CAP now. But you often occasionally find in the literature where it says the cyclic AMP repressor protein. It doesn't matter. Okay, I will call it CAP. And then your book calls it CAP. Okay. CAP is an activator protein, but it only works when it's bound to the cyclic AMP. Okay, so CAP doesn't bind in the absence of cyclic AMP. Where does it bind? If this is our gene, this is our minus 10, minus 35. It binds to a cis-acting sequence. It's a specific DNA sequence that we can call the CAP binding site. So when CAP binds to cyclic AMP, it can then bind to its binding site. It actually does so in a dimer. We haven't talked about dimers yet. Okay. And what CAP does is it helps allow the holoenzyme RNA polymerase to actually find and sit down on its promoter element. So what it does is it allows, if we write RNA polymerase like this, to come in contact with its minus 10, minus 35. It basically sets the register. Okay. It turns out that the binding site, the minus 10, minus 35, on a lot of these genes that are involved in degradation of sugar molecules, such as the lac operon, for instance. Okay, so this could be the lac operon. In addition to all the repression controls that you know about, you can't actually activate expression without having the cyclic AMP CAP protein bind down. And the mechanism by which it does it is that it makes a physical contact with RNA polymerase. The particular subunit of RNA polymerase that it binds to are those two alpha subunits. Okay, so CAP cyclic AMP complex binds to the alpha subunit of RNA polymerase and it basically stabilizes the interaction. It's a little more complicated than that because it turns out that what Cap also does is it bends the DNA. So a more accurate representation of what it looks like is that the sigma part of it's going to touch down on the minus 10, minus 35 RNA polymerase, then can come down on the promoter, and there's a contact between the alpha subunit of RNA polymerase and this activator protein. And so it's a combination of the holding down and tethering RNA polymerase to the right place and a conformational change that occurs in the DNA itself when you bend it. One of the common themes of transcriptional control is bending and twisting the DNA. It happens a lot, and it seems to be far more important than people recognized in the past. It's not just getting the proteins down, it's actually changing the helical pitch of the DNA a little bit. Okay? So now when Cap is bound and RNA polymerase holoenzyme is bound, you can then get transcription to occur. Okay. I don't want to go into more detail about how this works. Your text, chapter 12, the first few pages that I assigned goes into, basically explains this. Talks about different mutations that you can get in Cap and how that's going to affect transcription. You should also be aware that you've got these LacI repressor binding sites on LacOperon. You often have repressor binding sites. I want to talk about repressor binding just really briefly in the GAL operon, only because there's an experiment that I think is pretty cool to introduce you to a concept of dosage-dependent effects. Okay. Repression often occurs when a protein binds to a cis-acting sequence and it doesn't let RNA polymerase work. Okay? Activators often either bring RNA polymerase into place, or they tweak the DNA such that RNA polymerase can function better, or they bring in yet another protein to the DNA binding site. Repressors often work by excluding RNA polymerase from ever binding. That's not always true, but in bacteria, it's more often true. So they often bind to those operators and prevent RNAP binding. Not always, but occasionally. The promoter region, or the operon that I want to talk about, is the GAL operon. And the GAL operon is composed of three genes. It is in an operon, so they're going to be co-transcribed together. Okay, the three genes are GAL-E, GAL-T, and GAL-K. There is a repressor found somewhere else on the chromosome that's called GAL-R, and it makes a protein, which we'll just call R. That's the repressor. Okay. The repressor then can bind to operator sequences. The promoter is upstream. Why don't we just call this P now, because that's what your book is going to. So instead of writing minus 35, minus 10, I'll just write P. There are actually two promoters. There is P1 and P2. That would mean that there are two minus 10s, two minus 35s. This is really common in a lot of genes. What you'll find is that the organism wants to fine-tune them so much that there are two different control mechanisms that work independently. You often find that a gene may have very tight repression and yet may have a very weak promoter that's constitutive. Actually, I haven't brought up that word yet. The word constitutive means that you have constitutive expression. Okay, constitutive expression would mean that it's not regulated. Okay, we might as well get into some other terms. We often refer to expression of a regulated gene as basal expression when it's not being regulated, and then we talk about it being either induced or repressed. So you might see this one come up, basal, or basal levels of expression. And those are when it's not being controlled. These terms are not mutually exclusive, okay? You can have a basal level of expression from a constitutive promoter, okay? What that would tell you is they're telling you the amount of activity that you're getting from something that you never control. Or you can say the basal level of transcription was 5 molecules, 5 mRNAs per, you know, per cell. And when you induced it, it's now up to 1,000, okay? Does that, there are two terms that you can use them together or independent. If you have a basal level, it usually means that you can induce it or repress it. You do not induce or repress things that are constitutive. If it's constitutive, it's constitutive. You've often seen mutations in repressors that are constitutive mutations. If the repressor can't bind, then you can't regulate it. And so they call it a constitutive mutation. Okay. Does this ring a bell? If you have a LACIC mutation, what that would mean is in the repressor for the LAC operon, you have a mutation that now doesn't allow it to bind anymore. Okay? If it doesn't bind, then you're just always going to transcribe the LAC operon.
Basal just means below the level that you can regulate it then.
Basal is sort of the level that it's at before you regulate it. So a basal level of transcription might be, again, it's a term that's like phenotype. It's going to depend upon the state that which you're referring it to. Okay, a basal level of transcription for a ribosomal protein when you're in exponential phase is very different than the basal level when the cells are growing very slowly. But you can still call them basal because you want to refer it to something else that happens. Does that make sense? Okay. All right, where are we? Oh, promoters. Okay, so you can often have one promoter that is constitutive and one that's regulated. And something I also didn't mention that I should mention because it's something that a lot of students don't realize is that it's almost impossible to turn a promoter completely off. There's really no such thing as off. Okay, you can turn it down. You can turn it down, down, down to 1 or 2 molecules per cell. But the cells really can't turn a promoter off. And so when you're thinking about genes that autoregulate themselves, you know, it's a chicken and egg question. If you think about if a protein binds a repressor that then comes and represses itself, well, how do you ever turn it on to begin with? Well, it's because off is not 100%. Okay, there's no such thing as off. There is low, and then there's on. Okay. Okay. So this happens to have two promoters. I'm not going to talk about the two promoters right now, but because they're in your textbook, I thought I'd mention them. It has two operators. One operator is called OE, and it's for operator external to GalE. Okay, it's an operator that's outside of the promoter, but it is an operator sequence. The other operator is actually inside of the gene, and that's one reason why I'm bringing this up is because I think it's kind of cool. When you first start thinking about gene control, you think that most of the control has to be outside of the coding region, and that's not true, especially in eukaryotes. But it does happen in prokaryotes as well, that some of the control of gene expression happens inside of the coding region. Okay? This one is called OI, or inside of GalE. Okay. These two operators are bound to the GalR gene product in a cooperative manner. And I'm just going to tell you what happens. Because we need to get somewhere else. Okay, so they bind cooperatively. And this is really common as well. So GalR binds cooperatively. And when it does so, it ends up bending the DNA. this is OE, and this is OI. You get cooperative binding of the two molecules. So the repressors bind to their operator sequences, and then they bind to each other. So once again, we have an example of a regulatory protein that's forming a dimer, okay? And it's dimerizing by interacting with two different operator sequences. Those of you who know all about LAC know that this happens as well, okay? You get dimers of LAC-I binding to operators that then bend the DNA and pull it around in a circle. The promoters, in this case, are here. And the bending of the DNA basically occludes RNA polymerase from binding and recognizing those sites. Okay, so when you have two repressors binding to each of the operators, then you don't get transcription to occur. The other reason I wanted to bring this up is that it matters on what face of the helix that the operators are on. The distance doesn't matter. You could imagine moving this site here, and what would happen is you would just get a bigger loop. Okay, this loop would get bigger. But as long as you had a loop that occluded RNA polymerase from binding, it wouldn't really matter if you moved your operator a little closer or a little further. But what would matter is that you can make the bend. Okay? That if you flip, if you've got two sites that have to come together and touch each other, and you put one site so it faces in the other direction, then it can't touch. So you have to stay on the same face of the helix for both binding sites, okay, when they come together. Okay, so you can mess around with distances from one operator to another, and in this case, it doesn't matter whether the operator is found within the gene or not within the gene. You can actually move it quite a distance. There is a discussion in your textbook that I'd like you to read. I'm not going to go into it because I don't think I'm going to have time. And it talks about how do they clone? How did they find this internal operator? Okay. Or how did they know OI was an operator? And the reason I bring this up, I don't remember what the figure is. I'm sorry, I thought I'd get to it. The experiment that they did is they cloned the GALE gene on a plasmid. And the observation was that they got expression. I think what I'll do is I'll just draw the final panel. They got expression of the GALE E from the chromosome. Okay, let me just draw it. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because this is an example of a high copy mediated event. Okay, in genetics, what we do a lot of times is we make mutations, we look for second site suppressors. Another way of looking for interacting partners or for molecules that are in the same pathway are to play high copy games, where you throw in a whole lot of copies of something into a cell, and that throws off the stoichiometry of the players that are left. And so this is sort of an introduction to a high copy mediated effect. It happens to be dealing with protein binding to DNA, but it could be protein to bind to protein in a different situation. Okay? So the observation is, after lots of experimentation, if you have an E. coli cell, and this is the GAL region, this is the rest of the chromosome, this is GALR, it's expressed at its normal levels, it's going to make R protein. If you introduce into that cell plasmids that contain, we'll put both of them, OE and OI. Okay, so now this is a plasmid. The operator binding sites. If you introduce a lot of those plasmids, okay, there will be a normal level of R in the cell. But what R is going to do is instead of binding to the DNA where there's only one copy, it'll do that. But if you add enough copies somewhere else in the cell, all the R is going to then be titrated out by binding to those molecules. And what happens is you get gene expression, very high levels of gene expression, when you shouldn't. Okay? What you've done is you've titrated the GalR protein by adding the GalR binding sites. Which we know we just call OE and OI. Okay? This will be a common theme. We're going to mostly talk about it in terms of protein-protein interaction, but you can imagine that if we're looking for some interacting partner, you can do the same thing trying to do a protein complex. Okay? All right. It's fudge time. All right. So we've talked a lot about making the beginning of a transcript. We haven't talked about ending transcription. And I need to just introduce one mechanism in which you can end transcription in order to explain attenuation to you. Okay, when you reach the end of a gene or an end of an operon, okay, there's no reason to make more RNA product beyond where you need it. There are two mechanisms to stop transcription. The first is Rho-dependent. It requires a protein product, okay, which is called Rho, and I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to introduce the concept of Rho-independent. Which is the other mechanism that can happen. Basically, if you can be transcribing RNA polymerase and you can get to a point where you get a stable stem loop structure, you can stop RNA polymerase from working. Okay? The stable structure is going to, in a cartoon form, look something like this, where this region is very high in G plus C and you get base pairing. And what I want to do is actually draw out a terminator sequence for you because I want to make sure that you understand what direct repeats look like and everything else. And at the end, you have a sequence of U's. Okay, so the transcript continues this direction. This is the 5' end. This is the 3' end. When this structure is transcribed, the RNA polymerase will stop. Okay, so RNA polymerase actually just made this. And then it folds into the structure, and then that's recognized as a stop, and the RNA polymerase will fall off. Okay, that's this Rho-independent method. And so it's a structural signature that says, please stop now. Okay, let me draw out a real sequence so that you can see what the direct repeats look like and what this loop region looks like in case this cartoon makes no sense at all. So in the DNA at the end of the trip operon, way at the very end, the sequence coming in would be ATT, AAA. I'm sure this is in your book if you don't want to write it down. Ortiz. Okay, that's the top strand. The bottom strand is going to be exactly the same, but it's going to be complementary. Okay, so this is the DNA. Now, the DNA is going to have some inverted repeats and a loop. Okay, if you look at the DNA closely, you can see that from here to here is exactly the same as from here to there. Okay, they're inverted repeats. Is that clear? AAA, GGC, AAA, GGC. Of course, I forgot a C there, so it's not exactly the same, now, is it? G, what did I do? Anyway, GG. It is, okay. Okay, so I can't read my own writing. This region here is going to be the loop. Okay. These will base pair with each other, this part and this part. So in the RNA molecule, these four T's will, of course, be used because they're not going to be T's. Okay? If we wanted to put down the rest of them, if this was the 5' end, we could start saying that this was a C, that was a C, that was a T, etc. Actually, it would be a U, sorry. Okay? And on this direction, it's going to be the complementary base pair of those, so it would be G, G, A. Okay, we're just making the stem loop structure. Okay, but what's important is that when you make this sort of stem loop structure that's followed by a bunch of A's, or, well, in the coding A's, but U's, the transcription will stop. Okay, this mechanism of termination is used to control gene expression in some cases. And the example that has been most well studied is the TRP attenuation. And attenuation in various forms actually shows up. It rears its ugly head in a lot of eukaryotic systems as well. Not exactly the same, but the similar kind of process, so it's worth bringing up. Attenuation of the TRP operon. Let me give you some facts about the TRP operon. Okay, this is not a degradative thing. This is a biosynthetic pathway. So unlike the lac operon, where you want to chew up lactose and use it as an energy source, this is a case in which the cell needs to synthesize tryptophan if there isn't any tryptophan around. But it costs a lot of energy to make tryptophan. There's actually five structural genes, or five enzymes, needed to make tryptophan. And the cell would prefer not to make tryptophan if it can help it. The particular structure, again, these enzymes are in an operon, which makes it convenient, and so the regulation is all coordinately controlled. The operon itself looks something like this, where you've got TRP E, D, C. Again, you don't even know the names. Okay, there are five genes. We're only going to talk about a couple of them. And then there's this little open reading frame that I'm just going to label L for right now. Okay, there is an operator, so a binding site for a repressor, and there's a promoter region upstream of the operator. And somewhere else on the chromosome, there's a repressor. And the repressor is called TRIPR. Okay, so I should actually write the gene. The gene is little TRIPR. Okay. Now, in the case of TRIPR, TRIPR doesn't actually work all by itself. When TRIPR is empty, it's called an APO repressor. And it doesn't bind the operator. There are a lot of proteins that bind cofactors, and when they're not occupied by their cofactor, you call them APO. Okay, so APO is a term you're going to see a lot as you go through your studies, and it basically just means it's not bound to whatever it is you're talking about. So an APO repressor is something that isn't bound to something that it needs to be bound to. In this case, what it needs to be bound to is TRP. Tryptophan is necessary for this protein to bind to its operator. So when these two come together, actually I'll just put it here. Okay, when you have a TRP plus the TRPR protein product, you now have a repressor that functions. Okay. I'll give you the term. I won't make you know it. Just in case you get confused, tryptophan is called a co-repressor. I think think it's a bit confusing because tryptophan is an amino acid, and so to think of it as a repressor is a little confusing. It cannot bind to DNA. It doesn't care about DNA all by itself. It just happens to be necessary to make the conformational change of the bona fide DNA binding protein in order for it to bind. But technically, it's called a co-repressor. But don't think that it can bind DNA by itself.
Is cofactor okay in this case to call
it? It would be if it wasn't a genetic term. This is you're well immersed in 50 years of genetics terminology, and so you cannot call tryptophan a cofactor in this case. Had you done these studies in the 1990s, you'd probably call it a cofactor. I don't know how else to explain it. There are certain genetic terms that this will always be a co-repressor. It's the way it was defined. It was genetically defined first, and it probably is a cofactor, but if you ever said that to Charlie Yanofsky, the god of tryptophan regulation, he'd kill you. So best not to. Anyway, but yeah, it's a cofactor. It's needed for the function of this other thing. Okay. All right, so tryptophan synthesis, levels of tryptophan are important for control of the trip operon. When levels are high, it binds to the repressor then binds to the operator, and you don't make any of these genes, or these gene products. Great, you keep the gene products down, you don't try to make tryptophan. When you get in a situation where your tryptophan levels go down, then the tryptophan will fall off the repressor because you're gonna need that to make polypeptides. Okay, the repressor falls off and then you can start making the genes to make the gene products to make more tryptophan, okay? That's great, and that controls a lot of the regulation. That'll keep down the level of transcription down to about 10% of what it would be if you didn't have the tryptophan marker or the tryptophan repressor on. But it's far more complicated than that because life is. All right, there's a second level of regulation. So the first level is repressor binding. And the second level is attenuation. And if you just think about attenuation as making a termination, it's easier, okay? All attenuation is making a termination, making a row-independent termination either occur or not occur, okay? If you can control, so normally when the repressor falls off, let me make the repressor off, you're now going to try to transcribe this message. I'm going to put it on the bottom. If you could stop transcription from happening, okay, then you can control gene expression. You're not controlling it at the level of transcription of initiation, but you're controlling it at the level of finishing transcription, okay, and that's what happens. There is a specific termination that occurs before you get into TRIP E, okay? And it depends upon the level of tryptophan, okay? So there's a termination that depends on TRIP levels, okay? So once again, the phenomenon is going to be when TRIP levels are high, you're never even going to make full-length mRNA, okay? So this will happen when TRIP levels are low. And when TRIP levels are high, you're just going to make a bunch of these. So now I'm going to attempt to draw cartoons again. And I know how much you love it when I do this. Okay. Oh, all right. Let me keep that up there. Okay. What's going to happen is during transcription, you're either going to make one of these or you're not. Confused? Is this a hand? Yeah,
this is
your
hat. This is the rest of the hand.
Okay.
Wait, actually, I am a little confused.
Over okay.
Just the attenuation part about the trip again, the terminator right there.
Uh-huh.
The very last stuff that you added, just repeat it a little.
Okay, I'll repeat it. It's going to be easier when I show you what we do first.
Okay.
But the bottom line is you'll make a short transcript of 162 nucleotides when the trip levels are high.
Okay.
And you'll transcribe the entire operon, that's several KBs, when the levels are low. I'm going to do now is I'm going to blow up this little region here and hopefully explain it clearly.
Okay.
It is my goal. Okay. Let me tell you a little bit about this little thing I labeled L first. L stands for leader. Okay? The leader sequence has three features that you should know about. And I'm going to list them first, and then I will draw them. Okay, the leader sequence actually encodes a product. I drew it as a box, so it's going to encode a 14 amino acid polypeptide. It's a very small protein. Okay, and this is going to be one of these cases where the function of the polypeptide is completely just in regulating gene expression. It actually doesn't have a fate in life other than controlling the transcription. Okay, and this happens occasionally. You don't always make gene products for them to actually go on and do something that other than controlling some function. Okay, within the polypeptide, there are two adjacent tryptophan codons, codons within the sequence, and there'll be amino acids within the protein. Okay, tryptophan is a relatively rare amino acid. And so when you're translating an RNA and you have to put a tryptophan in, you have to find the tRNA that's charged with tryptophan to sit down in the ribosome in order to get translation. Having two in a row is pretty rare, okay? But this particular one has two in a row. And finally, the RNA has four segments that can form stem loops. Okay, and these are just labeled 1, 2, 3, 4. I think the easiest thing to do is to just draw you a cartoon of what a free RNA molecule would look like. If you were to take this 162 nucleotide sequence and you just synthesize it synthetically and ask what is the structure of this molecule, what it will look like is it'll come in, we're not drawing all of it, and it'll look something like this. The end of it has a series of U's, as drawn. It actually has 7 U's. This particular arm is base paired with this arm. Okay, so we're going to put making a stem loop structure. This is the free RNA. These two are base paired with each other. We call this strand 1, this part is 2, this one is 3, and this one is 4. So that's what these four segments are, just these linear sequences that can base pair. The amino acid sequence that starts up here, the two tryptophans are in this region. Okay, so these are the two tryptophans. And then about here is your stop of translation. Okay, so the RNA extends past the where translation stops. This is typical. This would be your 3' UTR. Okay, I haven't drawn the rest of your coding region or your 5' UTR. All right, so the free RNA can fold like this. Well, what happens when translation is happening? Well, we have two options. We can either translate when we have low tryptophan concentrations, or we can translate when we have high tryptophan concentrations. There is a correlation between the number of tRNAs that are charged with the tryptophan with its tryptophan concentration, okay? So when you have low tryptophan concentrations, what will happen is your ribosome, which is now here, will stall. Your ribosome, I don't know that we've mentioned this. In prokaryotes, transcription and translation are coupled. Okay. Transcription happens, and right after you start making that 5' RNA, the ribosome will hop on, and it'll just follow. So RNA polymerase is doing its thing over here. The ribosome's following right after, okay? But if that ribosome stalls on those codons for tryptophan, RNA polymerase will actually start making more of the structure. This ribosome protects segment 1 from binding to segment 2. What I didn't tell you is that segment 2 and segment 3 can base pair, okay? They're complementary to each other. So segment 1 is busy being bound up by the ribosome. RNA polymerase made 2, 3, and actually 4. But before it makes 4, these two can base pair. Okay? And if they base pair, you never make one of those. Okay? Remember, a termination sequence is high GC-rich base pairing followed by a stretch of U's. This stretch of U's is, you know, 40 nucleotides past where the stem loop structure is. So what happens is, if it stalls, you get translation to happen, or you get transcription continues. So, okay. So now what happens if it doesn't stall? Well, if it doesn't stall, the RNA polymerase and the ribosome are much closer to each other. Okay, and so what will happen is the ribosome won't be here, it'll be down here when RNA polymerase gets to the end. So what will happen is neither 1 nor 2 will be able to base pair. It's going to look something more similar to this. Actually, let me do this instead. Okay, if the ribosome's sitting here, even though these two could have base paired, they didn't, because RNA, or the ribosome sort of broke this apart and continued up. Segment 2 and segment 3 don't base pair because you've got this big ribosome on the way. So instead, RNA polymerase, which is now, RNA polymerase will stop after the series of U's because it will recognize the binding of 3 and 4 as a termination sequence. So this is when you have high trip levels. You go past the trip codons without a problem. And so the ribosome will basically be following RNA polymerase. 2 can't bind with 3, but then 3 can bind with 4 because of the distance. Your book goes into this in very good detail. I will make sure on the study guide that I draw a cartoon of it so that you can see what my interpretations of the cartoons. I'll make sure that on the study guide there's for sure questions at the cartoon level that I might ask types of questions on the exam in case these cartoons don't make any sense. Look back in your intro genetics book. Those of you who have molecular biology, I'm sure it's there. I know it's in your textbook for this course. You just may not have gotten to it. Okay? Thank you. Did that clear up? Yes. Okay.
So you said you had something right after this. Right after this.
I got it at the top.
Which
one? The one with the buttons.
Who's?
I don't know.
The fly guy?
Yeah.
Oh, he's giving us some of
them? Yeah, I gotta go.
Because 4 days, Nikhil and I were gonna be in Taco Bell too.
I know. 4 days, I'm absolutely freaked out about this. Can we meet tomorrow at some point?
Yeah.
Although, guess what time I don't have available. So I have a meeting to. I have on so many different things. I've got a meeting tomorrow from 1 to probably 3. I've got appointments from.
Okay.
I have some time right at
9,
but I don't know if we can get
here. Yeah, I'm spinning by 7. See you again.
So I wonder if we can get him to meet us at 9. I don't think I have my first appointment at 10 or 10:30.
Okay, I'm going to meet with him right now. Are you going to stretch right now?
Yeah, but I
Okay, I was thinking that was actually binding to the RNA, and that was it. Okay.
No.
Okay.
Yes. You don't need me, right?
I need you to just fill up.
Mike, I don't have a pen. I'll let you record it. I think it's the most stupid thing in the world. Oh, it's okay.
We're in another
belonging.
Yes.
Let's peek over. Hey, I already know. What's your birthday party?
I'm 40. City and state. What California is title. What does associate professor say?